Hello, everyone. My name is Themasip Khan, and I'm a co-founder and partner of Luma Group, an investment management firm focused on the intersection of the life sciences and technology. I'm thrilled to formally kick off and welcome our listeners to our firm's podcast, Illuminations, which aims to showcase some of the healthcare and biotech industry's greatest minds, leading scientists and innovators, entrepreneurs and investors. Today, we're honored to be joined by Dr. Rosanna Capeller, co-founder, president, and CEO of Rome Therapeutics. And now she can add the title of inaugural guest at Illuminations. Dr. Capeller is also the first entrepreneur in residence at Google Ventures, where she is currently a life sciences fellow. Rosanna and now Rome's work is emblematic of people and companies we look to invest in here at Luma Group. Luma Group recently joined the Rome family as an investor in their latest Series B extension round in September. We've long admired Rome for its focus on leading new frontiers in biology, such as unlocking the dark genome to develop the next wave of therapeutic approaches and insights for people with cancer, debilitating autoimmune diseases, and beyond. A little about the trailblazer herself. Dr. Capeller started her professional career at Millennium Pharmaceuticals when the company was leading at the forefront of the first genomics boom. After Millennium, Rosanna moved into leadership roles within the startup space, including Aileron Therapeutics and Nimbus Therapeutics. Now, as CEO of Rome, Rosanna possesses impressive science and technology expertise and can not only speak to her unique experience leading the company, but also the details and processes behind the incredible important innovations in the space writ large. So, without further ado, let's get started. Dr. Capeller, thank you so much for joining us. I know listeners would love to hear more about your background. What inspired you to pursue a career in the industry, particularly as a young person who grew up in Brazil?
Thank you, Themasip. I'm very happy to be here and to be the first guest of your podcast. That's fantastic. I was born and raised in Rio de Janeiro. Used to go a lot to the beach there, so that was fun growing up. But I was always very interested in biology. You know, I was that kind of kid that collected insects. Like, for example, I would go to the beach and get ladybugs and bring pairs of ladybugs home, and they would procreate, and my mother would scream that she needed to bring an exterminator because there were all these ladybugs in the house. Or I would collect butterflies, and I would skin snakes, you know, or collect tadpoles. So, you know, one of these kids that really wanted to know how organisms worked. And as I got older, I got more and more interested in medicine. Brazil is a very poor country, so I wanted to work on something that would benefit people in general. And I thought medicine could be a path to that. But I was always interested on what was behind it, you know, not just knowing how the heart works or the kidney works in a way that I can treat it, but what was the molecular basis of the different mechanisms and how we could manipulate that. So from a very young age, I decided that I was going to do medical school in Brazil. I was very young when I got into medical school. I was 17. My parents would not even contemplate sending me to America to study here at that age. They said I had to have at least one degree. And I stayed home, lived at home with my parents, finished medical school by the time I was 23. And basically a month after I got my diploma from medical school, I was in a plane to the United States, more specifically to Boston. And then I got into grad school at Tufts in the laboratory of Dr. Louis Cantley, which at the time was studying PI3 kinase. And the idea here was to really understand how things work. And even during my application for graduate school, one of the things I wrote is that I wanted to bridge the gap between the bench and the bedside. Nowadays, a lot of people talk about that, but at that time was pretty novel. You know, there was a big separation between medicine and science. The MD, PhD programs were just starting. And it was fascinating for me after I had gone through medical school, then now going to PhD and really start learning how things really work. But I just didn't want to learn how things worked. I wanted I want to really understand how it worked so that I could figure out a way that I could manipulate them, as I said before, you know, and the best way to do that is through medicines, through new therapeutics. And that's what attracted me to go into industry, because at that time in academia, you could not do that. You know, this is 30 years ago, was very hard to bridge that gap. So I was very interested in moving into industry.
That's very interesting. And as a recovering scientist myself, I know it's something we all stare at thinking, wow, drug development takes time. It takes collaboration. It takes a lot of hard work and probably a good amount of luck to get right. So as you're going through these steps in your mind of where do you go in industry, I'd love to just get behind your thought process on, of the myriad of options you had in this emerging ecosystem at that point, how'd you make the decision? And then equally importantly, what advice would you give to future, let's maybe just focus on future biotech entrepreneurs looking to follow your path?
I want to start with the advice first and then go back from there. I think you have to be persistent. You have to be passionate. You have to have a purpose. You know, this is a tough job. As you said, you have to have luck. And 90% of what you do fails. So if you don't have that persistence, that, you know, stamina for dealing with constant failure, you know, it's very, very hard to pursue a career in biotech or biopharmaceuticals. That's the nature of the job. You know, people always talk about the success. You know, oh, you know, we have this great drug for disease X, and we just published a great paper on journal Y. But people don't talk about all the hard work, you know, the perspiration that goes behind it. So you really need to like what you do and have a big purpose ahead of you. How you choose what to do, there is no linear path. Everyone is going to be different. You know, my path was I did graduate school, I did a postdoc, then I got my first job in industry and so on. Other people have a completely different path. They go and do a postdoc in industry first. I always stayed in the biotech side. I never worked on the big pharma side. A lot of people go into big pharma first, then they go into biotech. So there is no linear path. I think the most important thing is to choose carefully who you work with. At the end of the day, this business is made of people. And that is the key thing. You can have a great asset or a great idea. If you don't have the people to translate that vision into execution, basically you do not create value. So pay attention on the people. That's the key thing.
That's wonderful advice. And I think one, we perhaps under index on earlier in our careers, but as we realize the potential and power of collaboration and healthy groups, we know this is an exponential factor in any success of any endeavor in any individual person. So that is very well put. Thank you.
I think that as scientists, we're trained to be lone wolves, you know, and I think that we should be trained to network, collaborate, you know, and really pay attention on the power of socializing ideas, you know, very important.
I agree. As an investor focused on supporting breakthroughs, I have to ask you if there is a breakthrough moment in your own career so far that you're particularly proud of. And I understand even the greatest scientific innovations, perhaps in the moment, did not seem like breakthroughs to people. But in hindsight, when they thought back on their careers and their own personal inflection points, they probably realized, wow, that was a game changer. Had I not done that, ... And I'd love to know if there are many moments or maybe one singular moment you can talk about that you're proud of.
Yeah, I think there were many moments in my career where exactly what you said, you know, in the moment, you don't think it's a big thing, but afterwards, inside, you go, oh, my God, you know, that was huge. But I think that there are a couple of things from my experience at Nimbus that for me were key. I think the first one is that the whole idea of behind Nimbus was to integrate computational chemistry with, you know, computational chemistry with medicinal chemistry in a way that had never been done before, in which computational chemistry would drive the drug discovery process, correct? And I remember when I was interviewing for that particular opportunity, most of my med chem friends said, don't do it. People have tried it before. The technology is not up to snuff. It's crazy. You are a biologist. You're not a chemist. What are you doing in a chemistry company? And there was one person in particular who was a contrarian and said, you should do it, you know? And I said, okay, what do I have to lose? I'll do it. And the first thing that I realized was that med chemists and computational chemists did not talk to each other, which for me was a big surprise. And again, it's all about people. So I think that we had to integrate medicinal chemistry, computational chemistry. We did that in a very subtle way, meaning that both of them had to co-lead the project and basically decide together what compounds to make. And that actually sounds so simple, but is what made Nimbus work in the beginning, is to create that almost forced collaboration between the medicinal chemist and the computational chemist so that you could take the best of both disciplines, put it together to create something much bigger than the sum of the parts, correct? So that synergism between people, synergism between disciplines, for me, that was big and was a surprise. Okay, so this was one, and again, talks about the power of people. That technology is not enough, you know? You really have to have the right people. The second one, also at Nimbus, is that we're working on a particular target called AC2-CoA carboxylase, which was thought to be a great target for diabetes and obesity, you know, based on the genetics. And we're developing a drug to inhibit that particular target. And we did an animal study. And what that animal study told us is that, yeah, it was an okay drug for diabetes, definitely not a drug for obesity, but was a killer for fatty liver. Basically melted away all the fat in the liver. And I remember being in a meeting and someone pounded the table and said, oh my God, this is a drug for NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, at the time that NASH was really big and exploding. And for me, that was, again, a pivotal moment that you're going on one path and then suddenly data is telling you pivot, and you pivot. You have to pivot. And I think that that's the other big breakthrough in terms of understanding the value of the data that's in front of you and what it's telling you what to do. These were two areas, and I think the most proud one that I have is line one, but that I'm going to talk about when we talk about Rome.
You've gone through some exceptional journeys so far, and today you're here building Rome Therapeutics. And as we all know, Rome was not built in a day. And so I would love to learn the story about Rome and you.
It is, yeah, Rome is definitely not built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. And basically, the ideas start percolating when I left Nimbus to pursue my next opportunity. I was introduced to a very, I was introduced to an outstanding scientist called David Ting. He is a GI oncologist at the MGH, and his partner, Ben Greenbaum, who is currently at Sloan Kettering. He's a computational biologist. And the two of them having been studying the ribosome. So the ribosome is a part of our genome that basically encodes for DNA repeats. And these DNA repeats, these repetitive sequences, are generated from viruses that have integrated in our genome through evolution. So this is about 54% of our genome. And that's contained within what we call the dark genome, which is about 98% of our genome. So basically, everything that doesn't encode for traditional proteins, which is only 2% of the genome. So can you imagine that? 2% of our genome encode for the proteins that are the traditional drug targets. And 98% of it does something else. And we're trying to figure out what it does. And the most intriguing part of it are these repetitive sequences derived from viruses that have integrated through evolution. And what David and Ben had shown is that these repetitive sequences, which we call repeats, are highly expressed in cancer, but not in normal tissues. And they started looking at the regulation of those repeats, and basically what they could see is that in normal cells, the repeats are dormant, and only when cells are sick or subjected to environmental stresses like irradiation, sunlight, smoking, is that these repeats are activated. And why is that? What are they doing? What is the role of these repeats in human health and disease? And I remember the first time I heard this story, I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. You know, we are going to be working, you know, they're interested in these repetitive sequences that are never expressed. They're only expressed in certain disease states. We don't even know if it's the driver or the passenger, you know. And I told David at the time, interesting idea, but go do these three experiments. We'll talk in 6 months. And he did. He went back to the lab, did the three experiments I asked him to do. He came back to me a few months later and said, look, here's the data. What do you think about that? And in the meantime, I was reading more and more and more about the dark genome, you know. And then I was understanding more about the different elements that comprise the dark genome, what we knew about it, what most importantly, what we didn't know. And there was a lot that we didn't know. And after about 9 months of conversations, not only with the scientists, but also with investors, initially GV, Arch, and MGB, we decided that we were going to put a company together to test the hypothesis. And that's how Rome was created. And Rome is basically is the repeatome, correct? R-O-M, Rome. It's a contraction of the repeatome.
That's very clever.
So that's why the company is called Rome. And we're testing the hypothesis initially, how was the repeatome involved in the initiation progression of cancer? And at the time, I said, well, we should not only be looking into cancer, but we should also be looking into autoimmune diseases and neurodegeneration. And again, follow the science. And the science led us to establish line 1 reverse transcriptase as a key initiator factor of certain types of autoimmune diseases.
Well, that's very impressive. And there's so much to dig into there, but I'll start with one of the most exciting things I think always in science is when you discover something that's been staring at you in the face for a very, very long time. And in our traditional approaches at looking at the DNA, it's actually been our job to discount and remove those portions because they take up sequencing space, they make our experiments more expensive. We don't really know how to analyze all of these repeating parts of the genome, so we bioinformatically process those out actively. But you and your co-founders here took up an approach of, hey, we should actually pay attention to what's happening to the majority of the DNA, which means you probably had to build some very interesting tools that I know is at the foundation of what Rome does and why Rome is the company to be able to do it. Could you just talk a little bit about that infrastructure layer that you have laid underneath your city before you started building it?
This is a very good point that you bring up. In the beginning of my career, I was at Millennium, and that was in the beginning of the genomic boom. And we were sequencing our genome to identify new genes, you know, new kinases, new proteases, new phosphodiesterases. And I remember that we had something that was called repeat masker. So everything that was a repetitive sequence, we threw out. correct? So fast forward 25 years, you know, and now we need to go back into this, all these repetitive sequences that were considered the garbage, you know, and dig into it to find, you know, all the information that we needed to construct now our new genomic map that includes all these repetitive sequences. So we have a very strong data science team led by an incredible machine learning person called Menahem Frumer. And we now can map, because the most important thing is to map and measure those repeats. You know, in the beginning of the genomics era was the same thing. We had to map and measure all these genes. You know, where are they expressed? Where are they not expressed? You know, how often they are. And we're doing exactly the same thing with the dark genome to understand, you know, how these sequences are regulated and where they can possibly play a role in different states of human health and disease.
Today, you are tackling 98% of the DNA. And so the power of the dark genome and its potential for unlocking the next wave of therapeutic approaches and insights is magnificently large. How do you think about Rome's journey over the next 5, 10, and 15 years? And I'd love, Rosanna, if you can even talk a little bit about the thought leadership and the symposiums you've sort of ushered in and the buy-in you've gotten from so many of the academics and other industry folks. Just get to brag a little bit about what Rome has really created, which is much more than just a company focused on therapeutic assets.
Yes, as I said, that reminds me so much of the beginning of the genomics era 25 years ago, you know, where there were a few leaders that really pushed the idea that we had to sequence our genome and find all everything that was in there and understand the information, map and measure. And at the beginning, people said, oh, this is great. It's going to generate so much information. And then they didn't know what to do with all that information. And it took years for us to dig through all that information. But when you look today, so many new drugs, so many new therapeutic approaches are derived from all that work that we did 25 years ago, including, you know, all the stuff that we're doing today with gene editing, gene therapy, RNA therapeutics. You know, none of this would have been possible if we hadn't spent time 25 years ago to sequence the genome, map and measure everything that was in there. And at that point in time, we were focusing only on the 2% of the genome, as I mentioned earlier, that encodes for proteins. So you can imagine the power of doing this now with the other 98% of the genome. And it's not that we haven't sequenced the genome. We have, and actually about 3 years ago, there were 2 years ago, there was a papers that were published basically sequencing telomere to telomere and all the chromosomes. So now we have the full sequence of the 3 × 10⁻⁹ bases that we have in our genome, and we know where everything is. But now we need to understand what the different elements in the dark genome do. People don't know. You know, so for example, as I mentioned earlier, there are these viruses that they have integrated into our genome, correct? So they are called HERVs, human endogenous retroviruses. They look like HIV. You know, what are these viruses doing in our genome? What is the role that they play? Some of them are just pieces. So you can say these are remnants and maybe they provide some structure information. But some of them look like proviruses. They have everything in there to make a viral particle. Do they make one? They don't make one? What is their role in our genome, correct? And then there is a retrotransposon, which is a jumping gene. It's one of the only genes that we have in our genome that can jump from one chromosome to the other and keep jumping, even in somatic cells. And that comprises 20% of our genome. That's line one. Why do we have this? And this is conserved from, I think, yeast to human. You know, I mean, it has been conserved in all species, line one. So what role is line one playing? And then other elements like the ALUS and the science and the satellite elements, and each one of them have very precise regulation. You know, when they're expressed, when they're not expressed, most importantly. We also have found out that tumor suppressor genes like P53, one of the day functions is to regulate repeats, is to suppress the expression of repeats. So when you put this all together, you know, there is something very important that these repetitive sequences are doing. The other thing to keep in mind is that some of these repetitive sequences encode for proteins. For example, line one encodes for two proteins, one that has a chaperone motif that basically shuttles line one from the nucleus to the cytosol, and the other one that encodes a reverse transcriptase. So reverse transcriptase is a similar enzyme to the reverse transcriptase that's present in HIV. Why do we have an enzyme in our genome that can reverse transcribe RNA into DNA? And what we have found is that not only it can do that in the nucleus and reinsert itself into the our genome, and that's what's called the jumping gene, but that reverse transcriptase can also work in the cytosol, make DNA from RNA in the cytosol, and activate our host defense mechanism as it is a virus, a real viral infection. And when that happens, it can promote autoimmune diseases. So when that gene is deregulated for whatever reason, suddenly you have something that can cause disease, can work as a pathogen, and it's generated by our own cells. So, you know, and these are the discoveries that we're making right now, and it's starting to discover again like a gold mine. And sometimes I use the analogy of the tip of the iceberg, you know, line one and HERVs are the tip of the iceberg, what else is there? And of course, we're starting with repetitive sequences that encode for proteins that we can regulate with small molecules and antibodies. But I think you asked me how I think this is going to develop 10, 25 years from now. I think that most of these repeats are RNAs. So it's going to be much more our ability to target those RNAs, either use them themselves as RNA therapeutics or basically having modalities that can modulate the expression of these RNAs.
That's very interesting. And what you're also touching on is this trend that we've observed here at Luma Group, which is that the healthcare economy is rapidly changing and progressing in a way that makes things like discovery, development, and diagnostics better, faster, and cheaper. And I wanted to ask you, based on your own experience, as we've seen the precision oncology world go through a revolution, there are other domains that impact arguably more people, depending on how you look at some of those market sizes. Do you think these technological advancements will continue to move at the same pace, slower or faster, than the previous revolutions we've seen? May it be the genomic sequencing era, may it be the genomic editing era. I would love to just hear your thoughts, maybe opining a bit more on the industry at large.
I think it will. I think it will. Look at Alnylam. You know, they started the company back in 2002. It took them almost 20 years, 15, 20 years, but it has developed a completely new modality, now well accepted, of therapeutics, you know, which is based on RNAi. I mean, people didn't think about it 20, 25 years ago, you know. Same with gene editing. Who thought that you're going to be able to go in and edit a piece of gene, you know, or replace it or take it out? Or I think that we're going to, and RNA therapeutics saved the world. I mean, with COVID, I mean, the RNA vaccines is what saved the world. The more traditional vaccines didn't really work. I mean, thank God that we had that technology available to us. People had been studying it for 15 years, and suddenly there was the problem had the right solution, correct? You know, we had a hammer for that particular nail, which was fantastic. I think that things are going to continue to accelerate. And you touched on something very important, precision oncology. Precision oncology has completely changed the way we treat people with cancer. But that has not translated in other diseases. We need precision immunology. We need precision neurology. We need precision, you know, ID. We need precision everything, you know, to basically teach us how to treat people. Like I always tell folks that 40 years ago when I was in medical school, there were two types of lymphoma, Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's. One you treated, the other one you didn't have much to do. Nowadays, we're using precision oncology, there are, I don't know, 115 subtypes of lymphomas, each one treated vast in a different way. And for example, in autoimmune diseases, in lupus, everybody calls it lupus. It still classifies it based on the organ affected. We shouldn't be doing this. We should be classifying lupus based on the molecular basis of the disease, and we're still not doing it. And because of that, patients don't fully benefit from treatments because we don't know what we're treating. And I think that this is going to change in another 20 years. I think that everyone will benefit from precision medicine in a way that we're starting to see it now in oncology.
Rosanna, how much do you want to talk about? We've kind of danced around some of these topics of where the company is going and indications and programs, but
So the Nature paper itself, it's online and it's going to be published soon. Mm-hmm. You know, we have presented data at the ACR on our line one reverse transcriptase inhibitor for type 1 interferonopathies, which is a type of autoimmune disease that's driven by interferon. And we are planning to bring our new drug into the clinic this year. So that's the current goal. Again, the original idea of Rome, the company, was to unlock the dark genome, correct? Because as we have been saying through this podcast, we really believe that is going to be a treasure trove, and the insights that we're going to generate from unlocking the dark genome is really going to help us to develop the next wave of therapeutic agents for autoimmune disease, cancer, and neurodegenerative diseases. The first product that we have right now is the line 1 reverse transcriptase inhibitor for diseases like lupus. So that is going to be the first indication that we're going after. And after that, we have like a pipeline of other therapeutic agents against dark genome targets for different therapeutic indications. So that is the current state of the company. And again, as I said before, Rome is going to evolve as the science evolves, and the science needs to drive a lot of the decisions that we make in terms of where we are going to go with our therapeutic focus. But as we continue to evolve our knowledge, correct, and we continue to understand the role of the different pieces of the dark genome and how they play, we're also going to identify the different therapeutic modalities that are going to better modulate that. But we always thought that it was very important, as we are finding, as we are unlocking this new area of biology, that we were driven to get into the clinic as quick as possible, you know, with the first product derived, or the first asset derived from our work. What I'm trying to say is that sometimes people get so involved in the science, you know, that they forget that our job is actually to translate the science into drugs. You know, and for me, that was a very important saying, that one, the main purpose, the main goal of the company was always to get drugs to patients as fast as we could based on novel knowledge.
Maybe I'll ask you actually a question that is at the top of many people's minds based on sort of what you just laid out, which is, how do you build a successful platform therapeutic company, right? Because ultimately, what you're alluding to is you have all of these opportunities under one roof, unlimited opportunities, one could say, and with probably unlimited money, you could find unlimited number of drugs to find those opportunities. How do you decide as an entrepreneur, as a leader of a company, to translate some of these discoveries, even though you have a platform? Like, are you kind of getting what I'm getting at? Which is like, how many resources do you push into the asset and the clinical development, and then the future raises? How much do you say, hey, we actually have a platform. There's no upside here. Don't just write us to one asset. How do you, because people actually today in talking to all of these companies, the hundreds we've talked to, is this is what they're grappling the most with, which is you have this platform. Everyone's a little hedging, but they know they have to get the first thing out into the clinic and see how it goes, and that's what's going to fund the mothership for the rest of time. So how do you wrangle that balance?
It's so difficult because, you know, you hit the nail on the head. It's so difficult because, you know, 25 years ago when the millenniums of the world were around, people were investing in platform companies and new technologies and, you know, and you could do pharma deals for $50 million, $100 million, $200 million to discover new targets, you know. That didn't go really well, you know. Then you had the bust of the biotech industry in the early 2000s, and then the pendulum swung, and all people wanted was clinical assets, you know. Nobody wanted to hear about platform companies. Everybody wanted to invest in clinical assets. And then the pendulum swung back again, and everybody wanted to invest in platforms. I think that and now we're back into the clinical asset side of the equation. I think it has to be both. I think that you have to have a platform and a pipeline behind it, because the worst thing in the world is the one trick pony, or, you know, use whatever analogy that you want, you know, the one egg in the one basket things, you know. Our industry is an industry of attrition by definition. As I said, 90% of the things are going to fail. If you're going to invest in a company that has a single asset, by definition, that's not a good investment. However, you know, or let me put it this way, it may be a great investment for investors because they can, it's like playing the roulette. I am going to invest in many companies that have single assets. So basically what they're doing, they're calling them companies, but they're just running projects, you know. So you have project teams in different companies that are basically, you know, and then you say, okay, I'm going to bet on the 17, or I'm going to bet on 36. And then you create a portfolio of drugs. So for the investors, that is really good, not so good for the companies, correct? Companies really need to have a pipeline and a platform that will enable them to grow, because if not, they become a one asset company. And I think that that's the problem that we're having right now. Investors are pushing the companies to get into the clinic very, very rapidly. You know, they invest from their platform, you know, so that they can get things into the clinic. Clinical work is expensive, you know, so they all want to go into the clinic, and they all want to see, okay, now let me prove that I can do that, live to fight another day, then I can go back and refund the platform. It creates a real conundrum here, because it's expensive to build the team and build the platform, and to them say, okay, but we just want to take something to the clinic and play it out and see if we can get the return on investment. And then if the answer is yes, then we go back and rebuild the platform, you know. So it's a tough spot. And I don't have an answer for that. What the right answer is to mess up. I really don't. But my experience has been that it's bad to bet in only one horse. You need more than one, and you need always a dark horse.
I would definitively say, in your past experiences, you have successfully pulled off what many, many people aspire to pull off, which is the balance between a platform and assets. And this can, of course, be seen throughout your career and your previous companies, where they still exist. They have done terrific transactions that have yielded drugs that are in the clinic and helping patients every day. And so maybe, as parting words here, to rising entrepreneurs, to current entrepreneurs, to scientists, to innovators, what would your parting advice be on how to straddle the fine line between building the foundation and pushing things into translation and realization?
It's all about people. So pay attention to who you hire. That can be the most expensive investment you make, you know, if you hire well or not. Focus, stay focused on the big win. What is it that you want, you know, at the end of the day? You know, I always say, don't start with what I'm going to do 6 months from now. Start with what I want to be 3-5 years from now and walk backwards. You know, I think that that's very important. And pivot when needed, you know, you be flexible, pivot and all of that. Find the right set of investors. You know, I think that the other thing is that people get so desperate sometimes that investors are like, it's like you really have to match the investor with the entrepreneur. You know, it's not one shoe fits all. Everybody has a different need. So be careful how investors and entrepreneurs get selected. I think that's an important piece of it. And be persistent. Don't lose, you know, persistent, resilient, you know. Don't forget, you know, why you're doing this. Passion is important. Be passionate about what you do. Going back to everything I said before. And balance. You know, I think balance is very important. Don't get so enamored of what you're doing that you can't pivot. You know, one of the things that is very important when you're working on a program is understand when to kill that program. You know, people talk a lot about it. We scientists have a tendency of getting very enamored of our projects and taking longer to kill it than we should. Kill it. You know, if it's not going to go forward, if for whatever reason, you know, I mean, do everything that you need to do to get to that conclusion. But once you're there, kill it. You know, sometimes you need to be brutally honest and decide which program you take forward and which one you don't.
Wonderful. We very much look forward to it. Thank you for all of the work, Rosanna, you do for the community and taking the time to coming on to our inaugural podcast here at the Luma Group. We're honored to work with you and the team and look forward to a very exciting year ahead.